Okay, today is October 19th, 2011. This is Brennan Berg, a PhD candidate at the University of Texas at Austin, the H.J. Luther Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports and Institute for Olympic Studies. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, I'm interviewing Martha Rae Watson over the phone about her experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. So, Martha, can you just state your birth name and when and where you were born?
My name is Martha Watson. I was born in Long Beach, California.
Okay. And did you grow up there, or did you live somewhere else?
No, I lived there. Didn't leave Long Beach till I went away to college, Tennessee State in Nashville, Tennessee.
Okay. So, can you just discuss some of your early athletic pursuits? I mean, how did you first get involved with sport? Was that at an early age? Did someone in particular, like, really encourage your athletic participation? I mean, can you just describe, you know, your childhood in sports?
Well, basically, normal childhood. When I was growing up, sports was not the number one thing girls were expected to do. You're supposed to get married out of high school and start family and stuff like that. I'm a fifth child out of six in my family. My youngest brother and I were closest in age, so we played together more than I did with my older brothers and sisters, and he liked sports, and so that's what we did most of the time. And did all kinds of sports. I played softball. That was about the basic thing that girls did in the summer. We had a softball league with the recreation center, and they had a track meet, and that was about it. That's other than just playing ball or doing things at home with the neighbors playing sports. And my brother was a high jumper, and we used to high jump in the backyard. My dad had a janitorial service, and he would order these wax for floors in these 5-gallon cans, and I guess he didn't throw them away. You could redeem them like we do cans and sodas and things like that. So he would always have a couple in the backyard, so we'd stack them up with books or rocks or anything to make the standards. And then we actually had bamboo growing in our yard, and we used we had a bamboo that was our crossbar, and there was an old couch in an old lot about a block away from our house, and we'd go and get the pillows and stuff like that and bring them back into the yard and have our high jump pit. But we had to have everything cleared out before my folks got home. But that's basically how we started. And then when I was in junior high school, we had a principal. His name was Wilfred C. Kaplan. We called him Mr. Kaplan, but his nickname was Buck, B-U-C-K. And he saw that he had a track meet for the girls because we didn't do anything. We played paddle tennis, volleyball, softball, but we never traveled anywhere. We never went anywhere. The boys played flag football, and they played other schools and all that, but the girls didn't do anything. So he had a track meet for us, and I won the high jump and the long jump, I think. And he found out about some AAU meets and got us started. So that's basically how I got started. And in the ninth grade, he told me that you're going to the Olympics, and that he planted a seed, and that's basically where it all began. Went to high school. Of course, there was no programs there. We had play days and this and that. They did because we had a club at that point. Our parents had gotten together and and we organized a group called the Long Beach Comets. And when I got into high school, they did have they added a track play day, and of course our school won because most of the kids on my team, you know, we lived in the same area. But anyway, that's basically how it happened. And in 1964, I made my first Olympic team. Being here in high school.
Okay, well, so you said it was ninth grade. Your coach planted the seed of you're going to go to the Olympics. Did you immediately believe that, or was there a point after that that you started to realize that, you know, you did have a special talent, or that it was actually realistic for you to go to the Olympics? Did that come later?
Mr. Kaplan, who was not my coach, he was the principal at my junior high school.
Oh, okay.
He just, whatever he said, I thought was gospel. He was a very positive person, and I mean, he planted a lot of seeds at that school. There were a lot of kids that left there and did a lot of good things. This was not something that I thought about every day, but when the Olympic trials came and I had an opportunity to go, I didn't leave Long Beach saying, okay, when I come back, I'm going to be an Olympian. But I knew that if he had confidence in me, that it built the confidence that I had in myself. So it was not something that I could actually tell you that I had put a finger on when and where I was knew that I was going to be an Olympian. I didn't really know until I got to New York in Randall's Island and I made the team.
Okay. Well, how would you describe then, I guess, both your particularly your high school days, because a lot of the Olympians we talk to, they note how much time they had to devote to their training. Was there, you know, a lot of hours you had to put in that sort of made your life different from the other kids you went to high school with, or did you ever even think about that?
Well, you know, it's different now. When I was in high school, like I said, there was no program for women. I had to run for a club. Mm-hmm. And my high school did not contribute anything. They did not have, there was no CIF for women in track or baseball or softball or anything at that time. That did not happen until Title IX. I ran for a club, and so my family and my friends and my parents' friends supported us. The best thing that happened to us as a club is we had a student at Long Beach State where we trained. He was working on, I think it was his master's, we were his, his thesis, and I don't know what the title was, but he worked with us. His name is Ron Ellis. He's the head track coach at USC. He came and one of the family members, one of the mothers on the team. I don't know how they found him, but we needed a coach because we were just working with, just parents that knew we wanted to do, but we really didn't have anybody that was a real bona fide coach. So part of his thesis in graduate school, he trained our team, and once he got a hold of us, we all just excelled. And went out and found what we needed because it was not available for women in the school system. As a matter of fact, when I went to college, At that point, there were only two colleges.
Okay, just pausing the interview. Okay, we're back. And Martha, if you just want to continue where we left off.
Well, basically, I think I was saying that that my parents and the people, everything came from the parents and our club coaches that helped get me to the Olympic Games, because there were no programs in the school system for women. They did not emphasize athletics, and so that's where I give credit. And I was saying that Tennessee State and the University of Hawaii at that time in 1964 were the only schools that offered scholarships to women for track and field, and I chose Tennessee State. And even when I went to Tennessee State, we did not compete against other colleges. At that point, we competed. We were Tennessee State University Club and the University of Hawaii, the same thing. We ran AAU, Amateur Athletic Union, and we competed against, we went to club meets, AAU sanctioned meets, because there was no collegiate program for the sport. Tennessee State is where Wilma Rudolph went to school. Ed Temple was the head coach, and the tremendous, tremendous historian. That's someone you probably need to talk to before this is all over, because he has put more women on the Olympic team probably than any coach in history. And the Tennessee State probably has a lot more medals than most clubs do, because it was Wilma Rudolph and Mae Fagg, Edith McGuire, Wanya Tyus, Madeline Manning. Tremendous, tremendous program, but we still did not compete against other schools because there was nothing there, and not until Title IX, basically.
Okay, so you were at Tennessee State leading up to the 68 games. Was there anything about your time there at Tennessee State that just really stands out to you that was, I guess, different leading up to the 64 games for you?
Well, I was there with Ralph Boston, who is a three-time Olympian, and he has a gold, silver, and bronze medal in the long jump. So I was able to spend some time working with him, and plus being at a school that was noted for its sprinters, I actually had to really do a lot more sprinting than I did before, and both of those things helped me athletically, and so I was able to make another team in 1968. I graduated in 70, and then came back to California and didn't do anything for a while, and then decided I was going to start competing again, because I enjoyed what I was doing. But Tennessee State was more of a place for me to... We were students first. He emphasized education because, like I say, at that time, there was no money in the sport for us, me as women. So I got my education because of my athletic ability, and that's what I got. I didn't get any money in my pocket, but I saw the world, and I got my education paid for. And but basically what happened at Tennessee State was just the best 5 years of my life as far as growing up is concerned. I was in a situation where Tennessee State was one of the few black colleges that were established. I think there was about 200 of them before blacks could go to the white school. So it was a history lesson for me, and you know, the population was pretty much 100%, almost 100% black. So I was able to pledge in sorority without, you know, any kind of incident. I could run for offices. I could do anything without that race. There's no racial problems while I was a student there because most of the students there were black. So Tennessee State was a very good experience for me. It because it showed you what it felt like not to have things holding you back that were not in your control. You had choices, and you could make the choice, and you couldn't say, "Well, this is not going to happen because, you know, the race card and all that." So I really enjoyed my 5 years at Tennessee State because it took me that long to graduate, because there was no NC2A or NAIA or any of that, I was able to, you know, be there 5 years and, you know, compete.
Hmm. Well, good. So just leading up to the 68 Olympics, just given that you had participated in 64, did you feel, you know, completely confident about, you know, being able to make the 68 team after experiencing 64?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I knew who my competitors were. I was national champion, American record holder. You know, unless I had a bad day, there was no doubt after 64 that I was going to be an Olympian. 76 was questionable because it was about the end of my career, but with 68, 72, no, there was no question in whether I was going to make the team, no.
Okay. Well, something else we've discussed with a lot of the athletes leading up to the 68 games was just the altitude training that they went through. Was that something you went through, or did you go through any other kind of special preparation leading up to the Mexico City games? Can you describe that?
Well, personally, no. After you make the team, you know, you have to go to the training camp, which was in altitude in Los Alamos, New Mexico. So we trained there before we were here, probably 2 months before we went into Mexico City. Altitude affects, it has more effect on people that have to run more than like 400 meters and above because of the air and lack of oxygen. But if you're running 100 or 200, it's probably to your advantage. You notice that they have faster, shorter race times. We did train in altitude, but I don't know really scientifically how much it would affect me in the long jump because I'm on the runway and my approach was about 120 feet. So, you know, you're not going to go into oxygen debt at that point.
Right. Okay. Well, just covering a couple of other issues in the lead up to the Mexico City Games. Do you remember anything about the Harvard crew team sending out a letter, and did you receive it? Just talking about the possibility of protest or boycotts once the U.S. Olympic team got to Mexico City.
I don't remember anything like that. The boycott or the protest started with the men's in 68 we had the men and the women did not have the same training. We were separate in as organizations, so we had different training camps, different everything. So a lot of things that the men got, and this is where it started, we did not get. The men were in, I think, Reno up north, the track team. We were in Mexico. Because we talked and, you know, we heard things about the boycott, but we really, I personally don't really remember much information, just here and there, until we actually got into Mexico City. Once we got there and we were in the village, and then there was lots more information, but a Harvard crew letter I didn't know about. I know that we had a reunion at the Olympic trials in Louisiana. It was like the 68, so it must have been, maybe a 20-year reunion. I can't remember, but basically a lot of people showed up to the Olympic trials from 68. And we had a little gathering, and I think that's the first time that John and Tommy were actually, Tommy was there, John wasn't there. Tommy Smith was, that's the first time he had no idea how much support he had from the athletes and people in other sports, because right after their demonstration, within 24 hours, they were out of the village back into the States. So they didn't know what anybody thought about them, because all they heard was the negative part, but it was a really touching moment. But basically, in Mexico, that's when I really got more information and had any kind of awareness of the boycott or the project for the demonstration and what people were doing and talking about.
Okay. Well, just one other issue prior to the game starting was that there were a lot of student protests and violence in Mexico City about 10 days before the start of the games. Were you aware of anything like that, or did you see any remnants of that once you got to Mexico City?
Basically, not until we got there, and we didn't see anything. There was no signs of anything like that going on.
Did you get out and see Mexico City and, get out of the Olympic Village much?
Oh, yeah. My long jump was the first, after the opening ceremony, the long jump was the first day and second day, and then I was done. One of the things I remember most was we sat in the same place in the stand to watch the games. And there was a family that was sat right in front of us that had tickets for, I guess, that whole time. And there was a language barrier. I didn't, my Spanish was not that good, and their English was broken like mine, but we communicated, and I sat with them probably for about 4 or 5 days. Eventually, we would cheer for the Mexican athletes, and they would cheer for the American athletes. And one day, we were there, and they brought their lunches, and the lady, was her mom, she turned around and she gave me a sandwich. And we were told, you're not supposed to eat off the street, you're not supposed to drink the water, you don't want to get sick and all that stuff. And so she gave me the sandwich and nobody said anything, and I just thought, well, I'm done competing. So I ate it, you know, hoping I wouldn't get sick, but I just figured it would have been rude for me not to take it or say no thank you. We've been friends all week, and I ate the sandwich, it's fine, nothing happened to me. But, I'll never see those people again, but I will always remember that family, and I hope, you know, that they'll remember me, because that was, you know, the Olympic Games is always is something more than just the sports, it's the camaraderie that you take part in, and that's on the field and off the field. So there are lots of things. Spent a lot of time with Wilma Rudolph. She was there with one of the companies, that sponsored the games, and so I got to spend a lot of time with her. We went to other sports. I watched water polo, which I never thought I would ever think about going to see a water polo game, but I saw a lot of different sports. Of course, we went to basketball and boxing, and, you know, I really had a good time in Mexico because I was finished early so I could do some things that other people had, you know, you had to wait until your competition was done, but I was done after day two of track and field.
Oh, okay. So, can you describe, the accommodations you had while you were there? I mean, what were your impressions of the Olympic Village, and was the food satisfactory for you while you were there? I mean, I guess it was good that you didn't have to really concern yourself with it that much, given that you were able to compete early in the game. So, was everything, you know, satisfactory for you while you were there?
You know, it was as well as could be expected. We were not at home, and they built the village, and it was not totally complete, and, you know, a lot of concrete, but that's to be expected. They were good to us. I'm not hard to please, and I know when I go to other countries, I don't expect everything to be like it is at home. If you do, then you can be disappointed. You've got to learn to try different things, and you know. But they had basic. They had milk and eggs and bacon and cereal. You know, rice. It's you can always find something to eat. I mean, there was plenty. You could go in the cafeteria whenever you wanted, and you could get whatever you wanted. So I didn't really have a problem. I'm not that picky, really, about food.
Okay. What were your memories or experiences of the opening ceremony? Did you participate in those?
Yes. The opening ceremonies is always special for anybody that's in the games. The hardest thing was you spent more time outside the stadium than you did inside because, you know, you were one of the last teams to go in. Just the standing, but it's just, that's as part, as much of the games as the competition itself because it's, you take the oath. They light the torch. It's a part of the games.
Okay. Can you describe your event competition? I mean, how did you feel about your performance in those games and the outcome of the competition?
I finished eighth. I made it to the finals. They take 12 into the finals, and I made it to the finals. So I finished eighth. That was my best Olympic finish, so I can't complain. You always want a medal, but it just didn't happen for me. But that's a part of the oath is the winning. It's not about winning or losing. It's about taking part, and it doesn't I still would have wanted to have had a medal to come back, bring back home, but that doesn't happen all the time. And I was looking through some things the other day and kind of getting some things organized, and I have 4 Olympic rings, because I competed in 4 games. I have 4 rings from 4 Olympic games, and I said, well, you didn't do too bad. You didn't get a medal, but you didn't do too bad. You got 4 Olympic rings. Who has that?
Yeah, absolutely. So was there anyone on the U.S. Olympic team that you were particularly close with, or that you have particular, fond memories of?
Oh, everybody. Everybody on my team, and I have friends from other countries we're family. And and when I say my team, I mean the track team, the basketball team, the rowing team. That we're family. They still come to our Olympic trials, and we still have reunions at our. I've never missed an Olympic trial since 1964, ever.
Mm.
Because that's where I see my old friends.
That's good to hear. Well, also at the Mexico City Games, gender verification testing was introduced. Did you experience that? I mean, what were your thoughts on this?
Well, in 68, they took a hair sample, I think, or swabbed your mouth. I don't remember exactly what they did. Didn't bother me. Matter of fact, we got cards that certified that we were women. In 64, they physically examined women. Like they were looking to see if you had a penis or something. I remember 64. I don't even remember 68.
Oh, okay.
I have my card.
Okay. Another issue. While you were there, did you have any interaction with athletes from the Soviet bloc? What were your experiences or impressions of them?
Well, we compete and we see a lot of the same athletes all the time. So, between the Olympics, there's dual meets with Russia, travel there, we travel here. So some of those ladies, we exchange gifts. We are competitors, but we were not angry at each other. The Olympic Games is what I call the Third World War, where there are no casualties. There's some, at one point there were countries that wanted to, they can't beat us on the battlefield, so they have to, you go to the Olympic Stadium, and if they beat us there, that's a victory for them, but there are no casualties.
Mm.
But, like I say, once the competition is over, there's no animosity. I look forward to seeing those people, and even after I stop competing, I would see some of those athletes as managers and coaches, just like I was. So we would see each other again, maybe have a beer if we had a chance, but just to say hello and how you doing, and it's not somebody that I write to or know their addresses or know their families, but just recognizing, oh, there's Juan Terena. He was a 400-meter runner from Cuba, and now he's an administrator or something like that. Like I said, the Olympics, that was a family for me, and anybody that was on that, any Olympian is a family member of mine. That's how I feel about it.
Okay. Well, you discussed this a little bit earlier, but I just want to come back to Tommy Smith and John Carlos. The Black Power Salute is just one of the most enduring symbols in the history of the Olympics. Did you witness the Black Power Salute? Where were you when that happened?
Right there in the stadium.
Oh, okay. What was your reaction? What were your thoughts at the time?
I just, it was a demonstration. It wasn't violent. Nobody said anything. I don't remember any negative thing about it. I think the press took it and ran with it. Because during those games, they didn't even play the full national anthem. They only played a portion of it. So I don't even know if it lasted more than, wasn't a minute long. It was less than a minute long. So all the reactions came after, people got upset about it.
Yeah. So, just looking back on it now after all these years, what do you think? What did you think to the IOC's response and again you mentioned the media attention. Has your perspective of it changed over the years?
I don't know how much has changed. I'm sure there's still a lot of more things that could be done. But I think it was a demonstration, just like demonstrating on Wall Street, bringing attention to a subject, and that's what it did, and it did that, and it was successful, and hopefully it opened people's eyes, and things have changed because of that. The negative part was how John and Tommy were received, and they were not, I don't think they were trying to spoil the games. I was more appalled at what happened in 72. That to me was an insult to the games, but I don't think what Don and Carlos did was an insult. I think they had opportunity to say, what they wanted to say, and that's what our country supports, freedom of speech. And they didn't hurt anybody. I guess they made a statement, and you either liked it or didn't, I guess.
Okay. Well, just moving on, what were your memories of the media as far as TV cameras, photographers, journalists at the 68 games? Can you describe your interactions or experiences with the media at the game?
Well, I didn't meddle, so I didn't really talk to many of them. John and Carlos, they were trying to talk to people, and I felt a lot of times it put words in people's mouths, and instead of, talking to people, they were talking at people. That was basically that's all I can say about that.
Okay. Did you also participate in the closing ceremonies? What was that experience like after the game, as the games were finally coming to a conclusion?
Closing is kind of chaotic because it was optional, and I don't even remember if I did or not. I don't think there was no closing ceremony in Tokyo. I don't know when that even actually started. I don't even know if there was there probably was a closing ceremony, but I would not participate in the closing ceremony. It's just too chaotic.
Okay.
It's out of control. People are, I don't think that's a good idea. I don't think it's a good idea.
Okay. For you personally, what was the most memorable part of competing in the 68 games?
Hard to say. The family that I met was a special moment. Spending time with Wilma. Just being able to enjoy the games as a spectator was special, because that never happened again. But and my mom was there, so I got to, spend time with her because she'd never, she came to Mexico and she was in, came to see me in Munich too. So the things I remember are the times that I spent with people there. And I did finish, that was my best finish as well.
Okay. Well,
I got about 5 more minutes and then I got to go. We have to finish this maybe.
Okay.
I'm flying back to Las Vegas tomorrow. So maybe we can talk Friday morning.
Well, we could probably get this wrapped up here real quick. Can you just describe briefly what happened with your athletic career after the 68 games?
What happened to my what?
What happened with your athletic career after the 68 games? How did that...
I competed in 2 more Olympic Games, 72-76.
Okay, and then...
I ran on the relays this time, not just long jump, 4x1, 4x100-meter relay.
And then 76, after the 76 games, that's when you retired from athletics?
No, I competed through, and I went to the trials in 80. I didn't make the team in 80. It was kind of a tough year. The day I was still leaving for the Olympic trials, my father passed away.
Oh, okay.
So it was kind of a, and then with all the boycotts, there's a lot of politics, and this was not a that was my last attempt for an Olympic team. So I retired in 82.
Okay, just wanted to get that clarified for the record. How do you think your life would have been different had you not been an Olympian?
Start all over again, I didn't hear.
Oh, I was just asking, how do you think your life would have been different if you had not been an Olympic athlete?
It would have been totally different. I mean, I have no idea what it would have been like. I guess I would have just got married and had a family like my sisters did. Probably wouldn't have been a bad life, but it would have been different.
Okay.
My sisters are all happy. They have kids. I don't have kids. They have kids and grandkids. I don't have any of that. So I gained something and I lost something. But it would have been different. But I think I still would have been okay.
Okay. And just one final question. What is one piece of advice you would give to today's Olympic hopefuls?
To today's what?
To today's Olympic hopefuls, any athletes who are aspiring to go to the Olympics?
Just do it as long as you enjoy it. Work hard and be selfish with your goals. Don't let people make you feel bad that you have to make decisions that may not please them, but it's going to get you where you need to be, because your career is going to be over and you'll have plenty of time to do all the other things that you wanted to do. You just have to be focused, and as long as you're enjoying it, your sport, you need to stay and do it.
Okay. Well, Martha, I know you got to get running, but we really appreciate you taking your time to just share these experiences with us. So thank you so much.